Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach. Starring Jake McClure this week, Jeff being out, not feeling so well. So send him your best. And I know we have at least one listener. Philip, thank you for thanking me for the program. And happy Easter to you, which leads me to my next subject. We're going to go into a strange set of creatures. There are six mammals that lay eggs. What does this have to do with the economy? We'll see shortly. The animals that lay eggs are centralized in Australia and New Guinea, except for the sixth one. There's the duck-billed platypus, the western long-beaked echidna, the eastern long-beaked echidna, the short-beaked echidna, the Sir David's long-beaked echidna, and a strange pastel-colored bunny that shows up in early spring, kind of all over the North America. Not to be confused with the large chocolate bells of France. This is a bunny that is at home in North America and in Northern Europe. Strange pastel egg-laying bunny. Happy Easter, everyone. And I know a lot of you say that's not the reason for Easter. There's also religious meaning there, and it's wonderful. It's a speaking of hope and so on. Well, so is the bunny. It's just a longer, older religion of fertility and the coming of spring. Put it all together. And I know it's kind of a weird thing. A lot of times people look at a religious holiday from their own perspective of whether that's Christianity or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever. When there's a shared history there, the word Easter comes from the goddess named Yostr, which is a Northern European goddess of fertility and spring. We spoke last year a bit about the concept of the Catholic faith. The reason why we still call it Easter is because when people converted to Christianity in Northern Europe, they didn't want to give up their festivals. Those are fun. And the Catholic Church didn't want to make them give up the festivals. They're happier people if they celebrate the coming of spring and the harvest season and the longest night of the year and the longest day of the year. These are things that people have been celebrating as long as people have been looking at the sky. And you need breaks. So it's not surprising that just about every religion on the planet celebrates spring somehow. If you're celebrating from the concept of the rebirth and resurrection, then that is a beautiful way of celebrating. And if you're celebrating because animals are giving birth and there's new growth, it's the same concept of hope and newness. And why am I adding this all together? There's possibility of a lot of people being offended by talking about religion like this. Because from an economic perspective, it's very, very important. I mean, Black Friday it's the day after Thanksgiving when retailers suddenly make enough to make a profit for the year. Well, what does that come from? Well, purchasing for Christmas, which is one of those festivals that has a very long tradition before Christianity and after. The reason for it is there. Spring has a rebirth in the economy as well. We're through the winter. So these phases that we mark throughout history in our calendars and in our religions for different reasons come through on statistics and in demographics and on our outlook on life. So happy Easter, everybody. Enjoy it for the reasons that you enjoy it and be open to everybody else about it. I think that I think it's important that people be encompassing of love wherever it comes from. All right. So back to what we were talking about last hour. I think I wrapped up the banking system. If you guys still have some questions on that, specific ones, this is a good time to send them in. I'm going to switch the subject now to some other areas of the economy than just banking. No, it's interconnected. So home prices fell in January for the seventh straight month across the nation. That's a big deal. A year-over-year basis, we're still up 3.8% on home values from January to January, but it's down 5.6% from December. That's a big drop in 1 month in the value of houses across the nation. 5.6% in a month is faster than the prices were rising. So what does that mean? It means that it is you can't necessarily get that same seller's market that you were having before. There's places where you still can. Central Texas is still in that category. Listing a house in Central Texas, north of Austin, not in Austin, typically the first couple of weeks come in with multiple offers above the asking price. In Austin, that's not the case right now. Most offers are coming in below asking price at this point in Austin. So it kind of gives you a concept of what's going on in the world. Central Texas is in a weird spot, north of Austin and way south of Austin, because a lot of people that are moving to Austin, and people are still moving there, don't want to pay the Austin housing prices. So they're buying in Buda, in Jarrell, in Temple, way, way up away from the Austin area. And you can see this around Boston. You can see it around Denver. You can see it around San Francisco as well. So just know that there's a downward pressure on housing prices. And if you listen to us in 2017 and 2018, even as far back as 2016, you're going to hear something weird. We predicted this. We didn't know that there was going to be a pandemic. We certainly didn't know that the bank failures with SVB and Signature were going to be around. We didn't think that we were going to have high inflation between then, but that's a normal part of history, and it was made it easy to predict. What is it that we predicted? We said, coming out of the Great Recession, housing prices plummeted. They just tanked because people realized we had too many houses. People were building houses and selling housing at a very high rate of speed. The people that were buying the houses were buying them to sell them to someone else rather than to hold them or live in them. So we had a lot of extra houses, and it put a lot of builders out of business. It put a lot of the house building companies the employees were decimated by this. You can see this in the illegal immigration records. In the early 2000s, in the early aughts, is it the aughts or the noughts? They're all the same. We had about an 11 million person illegal population, which is a pretty significant portion of the economy, of the populace. After the recession, or during the recession, about half of that population went back to Mexico, because a large percentage of that population was from Mexico. We may have a larger population today of illegal immigrants. It's hard to measure this stuff, and usually you have to find out about it 5 years after the fact. But the population isn't centralized in one country anymore. It's across a large swath of South America and much, much smaller from Mexico. Well, why? What's going on there? It's a different kind of illegal immigration as well. Back in the early 2000s, most of the illegal immigration was a single person coming over, not a family. And you can look at that at where the Border Patrol was picking people up, and the statistics are pretty clear coming through here. What were they coming over for? Well, to work. We were employing them, building houses, mowing lawns, in hotels, in restaurants, generally in the kitchen in the restaurants, and generally in the cleaning services of the hotels. Okay, we'll jump forward to the Great Recession. People didn't eat out at restaurants as much, and people weren't going to hotels as much. So the population dropped. That's a big deal. Coming back from that recession, these builders that were building, both the employees, contractors of the company, illegal or legal, they were out of work for a while. They had to find something else to do. A lot of the framers became carpenters, which has a different level of things that they can sell. They can sell furniture and cabinetry instead of just framing a house. And then 10 years later, as the building starts back up again, 2018 or so, we say, all right, we got to start building again. And we realize the experienced workforce that we had before isn't there. The average age up in the early 2000s of the worker on these job sites was in the late 40s and early 50s. These are people that had a long experience in building houses and in masonry. And you come forward to 2018, they're not in their late 40s and early 50s anymore. Now they're in their late 50s and early 60s. and they didn't come back. So we had fewer and fewer people to build the houses, which caused the labor prices to come up. This is fascinating stuff. It doesn't mean that I am advocating for or endorsing in any way illegal immigration or any of this. It's just economics. There was a population here working that isn't here working anymore. That raises the cost of labor, period. Are there things you can do to lower costs of labor? Sure, you can bring immigration in legally, you can do it illegally, but you have to have a trained workforce. And if you don't have a trained workforce, you pay the people that are trained more because you want to keep them. So prices were up there. Come forward a bit. It's still hard to grow and build new houses. So housing prices start up. Interest rates are low, have been low. You know, they're going, this is period time, 2018 coming forward. And then we have the pandemic hit and house building came to a screeching halt for about a month. And that has a big impact on overall building. If you're halfway through a project or you're just starting a project and you stop for a month, there's a lot of stuff you got to come back to and figure out where you were. It slows down the whole process. This is a big deal. This is a huge deal when it comes to how long it took to build the houses. At the same time that the pandemic hits, people who were relatively satisfied with their abodes, their place of residence, are now stuck inside that abode for an extended period of time with nothing to do except for look around at the things that they don't like about where they're living, which caused a lot of people to get into the housing market. Cabin fever tends to make you want to move. It doesn't matter that moving to a different cabin is still going to give you cabin fever. And there's a lot of buyer's remorse over the purchases of wherever they went. And they were like, I bought this for the wrong reason. I should have waited. The pandemic is a weird time and we'll be studying it for years and years to come. I think one of the big things about it, when I ask people how long they were stuck in their house and not able to go to work, I get a range of answers that is amazing. Anywhere from, oh, it was no more than a week, to several years. And none of those answers are correct, by the way. It's a very weird behavioral issue when we're thinking about memories. Memories, especially long-term memories of when things occurred and how long they lasted, are built around major milestones in your other memories, like Julia's wedding. That's a good example. I don't know Julia. I'm just using her name. Julia's wedding. Was that right around Julia's wedding? Oh, okay. That's how long that was. We didn't have milestones during the pandemic and the lockdown. So it's like this homogeneous time where you can't really figure out when it started or when it ended in your mind. And I really, those of you that are listening right now, I want you to think about that for a second. How long were you stuck in your house? Because we were all stuck in our house at some point. How long did it last? And you have these vague ideas of, I think about, but the reality was that most people were stuck in their house about 7 months. Some people remember it as 2.5 years, and other people remember it as only a few weeks. But when you start talking about it, you realize, whoa, this was more than half a year. And it was really, really, there's no landmarks in there. There's nothing standing up above the other memories to say this is how long it lasted. Even the changing of the seasons is hard to figure out back in the pandemic. When did it start? When did it end? It's fascinating stuff, and we'll be studying that for a long time. It affected the housing market tremendously. So now housing prices are coming down. Well, why are they coming down? We still don't have enough houses. We haven't overbuilt like we did before. We still don't have enough people building houses. Why are housing prices coming down? Isn't this supply and demand? Well, the Federal Reserve destroyed some demand, and it's called demand destruction in the academic world. Demand destruction. What is it? Well, it made it too expensive to buy a house. Housing prices weren't enough. The interest rate on the mortgage is way up now. So the amount that you're spending per month is a lot more. That's important. It's really important to understand. We still don't have enough houses, and there's still builders out there building, and some of them might go out of business because people aren't buying the houses yet. This is going to stabilize. We absolutely had a bubble in the housing market. We absolutely had a bubble in the used car market. Now, it was a temporary thing. It was based on not having enough at the time. And we're getting that equalized over the last week, by the way. Used car prices have dropped down below new car prices for the first time since about September of 2020. So those of you that were waiting to sell your used car till the very top of the market, you're past that. It's been coming down for a while. You shouldn't be timing the sale of your used car like that. And at some point, those used cars are going to be worth a lot less when the new cars have a lot of innovations. And that's really, there's a lot of stuff to talk about on the innovation front. When I talk about not enough houses on the market, meaning that this is a temporary downturn in the housing market, that's something to just be aware of. Until we build enough houses to meet the demand for a big chunk of the younger generation that wants a house that can't have it, then housing prices will recover. That's just the way things work. At some point, they will buy their house. They are not going to live with their parents forever. There were all these myths that people talked about, oh, maybe this new generation is just comfortable living with their parents. No, it's not necessarily that they are not comfortable living with their parents. It's that their parents are not comfortable living with them. The feathers are being removed from the nest. It's not quite as cushy and warm as it used to be, even though it's expensive to get out. So what else is going on in the big wide world? Talking about used cars and how that's not a great place for investing at the moment. It can be if you have the right car and you recognize that internal combustion at some point is going to disappear. It will. Not because of ecology, not because of the green movement, but because economically it's a lot more viable to use an electric vehicle at some point. As if technology just goes on the discoveries that we've already made in batteries, the discoveries that we've already made in motors and in software, then electric cars are going to surpass internal combustion regardless of what any government does. And if you like internal combustion, it's not going to be impossible to get them. It'll just be a niche market. If you think about, and Salado is where our firm is based, Salado, Texas. And it feels like every weekend there's an old car event. There's a lot of old cars that come from the 1920s all the way up through the 1980s. And that will eventually be all internal combustions at some point. And one thing that is very noticeable on these parades is if you're standing on the side of the road as they drive by, it's stinky. It's really, really stinky. And if you had only those cars on the road today, we'd have a lot more pollution than we do. It's the only kind of car that was available when they were made. They didn't have the exhaust controls and the cleanliness that had to happen. So that's come along a long ways. And cars, internal combustion cars, drive a lot longer than the old internal combustion cars did. These cars that are driving millions of miles now, when it was a kind of a milestone to hit 100,000 in my childhood. And this is normal. Technology is proceeding. Why do I say internal combustion is going away? It isn't because I don't like it. It's because the new technology is better. If over time it's less expensive to buy an electric car and the electric car drives as long or longer than you would on a tank of gas, and you can make the time to recharge as quick as a tank of gas or quicker, then why wouldn't you? If it's cheaper and more efficient and more comfortable, of course you will. And I remember people talking about windows in the cars, you know, the crank window versus the electric window, where you push a button and it goes up and down. And they go, well, I don't want to pay that extra. Well, it's not extra anymore. It's kind of extra to get the crank because they don't make them like that. There's a few places that do, but it's still, it isn't a price point issue anymore. They don't give you a benefit for not having the electric. In fact, sometimes it's more expensive to have the hand crank. Why? Because they don't make that many of them. So coming forward, if we're talking about coal or natural gas, why is it that the coal industry is still in massive decline? We had a president who based a lot of his early rhetoric on saving coal. During the Trump administration, money was poured in from the government to save the coal industry. It's not working. Why not? Don't we want to save coal? Well, technology's moved beyond it. Coal is not as efficient or as clean to burn as natural gas. If it costs less and is more efficient, people tend to use it. I mean, just look at Amtrak. Amtrak was the way you got around on trains for a long time. is the way you traveled across the country. And we're putting a bunch of government money into it to preserve this as a method of transportation. But if it's less expensive or more convenient overall to use a different way, then people do. It's not profitable to run the Amtrak. And it's a money loss to the U.S. government and has been for decades. Should we get rid of it? That's not what I'm about. I'm not talking about getting rid of it or not getting rid of it. I'm saying it's a replaced technology that we're hanging on to. Coal, the only reason why coal would stay as a technology for energy generation is if we pay extra money just to have it as a backstop. I don't know why we would do that. Electric cars are the same way. When they become cheaper and more efficient, then people will move to them. And it's begun. People are moving that direction already. Now, if you're living in a city, it's probably far more efficient to have an electric car than if you're in a rural area. If you have to drive a long distance, the battery life isn't there yet. But just looking at the technology that's already been developed, the research that's already done, prototypes that have already been made, the length that a battery will last is getting a lot longer. Don't expect that on the market this year or the next 5 years. But after that, you should expect to see a battery that'll last 3,000 to 6,000 miles before a recharge is necessary. That's just existing technology that's being implemented. There's big stuff going on there. When it comes to the world of medicine, new stuff is coming onto the market at a massive rate. And by the market, I mean practice. What is the new stuff? It's all so new that they have to completely retrain the doctors to use it. Nobody knows how to give these treatments. They're very customized gene treatments and things that are working on different kinds of cancer and on different types of genetic disorders. But they come with all kinds of very high-tech stuff, like they've got to be stored at a certain temperature, generally like liquid nitrogen stuff, minus 238 degrees, stuff like that, and then cooled off or warmed up in a very careful process, have to be administered within a given period of time. It's a very, very delicate process for a lot of these new treatments. But the new treatments are there. And the long term of that is that our life expectancy is going to go up. There are lots of new things coming onto the market right now. And I said this at the depths of the lockdown of the pandemic, that we would see an explosion of new treatments coming out over under the new FDA rules, making things come out faster. It's a big deal, a really, 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 really big deal. A lot of incurable diseases are no longer incurable, and a lot of money is still being focused in that area. So just on the medicine front, that's cool. Now, we have a lot of broken stuff on the medicine front. Trying to figure out how much you're going to pay for something in advance is nearly impossible if you have insurance. There's all these patients' bills of rights. Then you go to the hospital or to a doctor, and they give you this. You have the right to request a firm estimate on what the procedure will cost you up to a day before the procedure occurs. That right is only available if you don't have insurance. It's weird, huh? You don't get a say or get to know what your procedure is going to cost in advance if you have insurance. And I think that's broken. I had a procedure done in 2020, and I spent 4 months working with the hospital system to try to get an estimate of what the price would be for the procedure, and I didn't get one. They didn't know. They couldn't know the procedure price because they hadn't done their negotiation with the insurance company that week. And each insurance company has their own negotiation. It's weird. The doctor doesn't know what the procedure is going to cost. Even when doing the procedure. I mean, where else do you go to buy something that the person selling it to you doesn't know what the cost is and you still buy it? Oh, college. That counts. At least then you know what the price is at the point that you're paying it. With health, you don't know. Now, Wall Street Journal has done a lot of exposés about this, but the reality is it's a bureaucracy. It's a massive bureaucracy at every level, and it's run by... Its foundation is based in the concept of the codes issued by Medicare. Those medical codes that are applied come from Medicare, and they have agreed that Medicare will pay X amount of money, and that's the standard that all negotiations start with at the private insurance level. This is the Medicare price. And then they go up and down from there, and it's all over the map. One hospital could pay, could doing one procedure, the same procedure on 14 people, could have 14 different charges of differing amounts of money for that procedure, depending on what insurance company it is. How's the doctor supposed to know that? The doctor is supposed to get trained up on what they're doing. And that doctor is lacking in training on all these new techniques that are coming out, which are also expensive. And the training of the doctor is expensive. So trying to figure out all of this, there's whole departments at hospitals that have nothing to do with patient care. They're just trying to figure out what things cost. What is it? And they generally find out well after the fact. This is a problem. The technology that's coming to medicine is amazing. And we have a for-profit world on the pharmaceutical side of things that is making amazing new techniques and amazing new treatments that are saving amazing numbers of people. And when they come to market with it, they're going to charge something because they want to keep making new stuff. And they also want to be profitable because that they are for profit. They're generally publicly held, publicly traded companies with stocks going to them. And then the hospital has to buy the treatment from the pharmaceutical company. And they have to negotiate that rate with the pharmaceutical company. Then they have to negotiate a rate for the treatment with the insurance companies. And then they have to have a standard rate that they apply to people that don't have insurance. And it may have been easier if I had just said, hey, I don't have insurance. What is this going to cost me? And then say, no, I have insurance. But then that may have delayed everything and it wouldn't have been correct. So we have a major Frankenstein of socialism and capitalism in medicine. And it's been around since way before Obamacare. We talked about this at the time that the Affordable Care Act was passed. We've had a socialized medical system since the 1980s, when a law was passed that said not-for-profit hospitals, if they have the capacity to treat trauma, must treat the trauma when somebody shows up, regardless of their ability to pay. If somebody's spurting from a major vein, and they come in and they've got no proof of insurance, they're buck naked. If it's a not-for-profit institution, and the vast majority of hospitals are, they've got to treat that person. That's an obligation that's been there since the 1980s, and it's an unfunded obligation. The government didn't say, and we'll pay you money for that. They said you have to do it if you're not-for-profit. That's why you're not-for-profit. You're here to help people. So how do they get the money? Well, they charge the people that have insurance more money to care for the people that don't have insurance. That's why insurance rates go up. Okay, so come forward, they made it easier to get insurance during the Affordable Care Act. You can have all kinds of political arguments over whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's, in my mind, it's irrelevant. It's a thing that exists. So now that lowered insurance rates for about 5 years, and then they started back up again. And since then, insurance rates have gone up at a much higher average rate than the market, much higher. And if you look at some of the greatest earning companies in the market, you're looking at health insurance companies. So there's some real problems that need to be fixed. And this glowing optimism of new treatments coming. If we look at our medical system today, and from my early adulthood, there was a lot of push to say, hey, let's socialize medicine completely. Let's make it look like Canada. And they said, no, we can't make it look like Canada. Have you ever been to a doctor in Canada? You've got these long, long wait lists and you can't get the treatment that you want. You can't go in same day. Well, guess where we are now in our sort of for-profit system? It's going to take you, you got to get on a waiting list to get on a waiting list. There's not enough doctors. There's not enough nurses. There's not enough nurse practitioners. So the prices are going up. We got to figure that out. And if you think of it from a perspective difference. College is the same way. There's a lot of federal money available in college, which means negotiating for your price of tuition is not a thing. It used to be a thing. You used to be able to negotiate, but then government money came in and either made it free or gave you the ability to get a loan so that you everybody knows you have the ability to get the money. So how could you negotiate? And if you look at college professors and doctors today, they're making much, much, much more money than they did in the 1960s. Adjust for inflation all you want. That's what I'm talking about. They're making huge amounts of money more now than they did then. That's probably a good thing because we need more of them. You know, the old, the professor that walks around with the suit jacket with the patches on the elbows, those leather patches, they look very sophisticated. Well, the reason why those patches existed is because they couldn't afford to go get a new jacket because the pay was so low. And doctors had to get in their car and drive to go visit their patients, and their pay was really low. And if they had medical bills or had medical student loans, it took them forever to get them paid off. Well, now we've reversed that. It's gone the other way, so that tuition and so on has risen. Medical rates have risen. So doctors are well compensated. Professors are well compensated. It's likely that we'll swing back the other way at some point. We might not, because there's not enough of them to go around, and we still want more of them. So these are issues that have to be dealt with. Figuring out the transparency on what we're paying in medicine is huge. We really need to get that fixed, because that's something that all of us have in common. We all need it at some point. So getting that fixed, also not on any major political agenda right now. I feel like there's a lot of very specific items that are about the day-to-day life of people that are missing in politics, and we're wrapped up around some items that most people don't have impact their life. Abortion is one of them, and I know that's a hot topic, but if you think about how often you personally are involved in an abortion or someone that had an abortion or should have, it's a very small microcosm of your life, tiny, versus going to the hospital for anything, or the student loans. I am not saying that the government should forgive student loans, but I also recognize that if a institution gets the majority of its money from student loans, it in essence becomes a monopoly. It has the price control 100%. Nobody gets to negotiate. And if it's a good enough price, that's fine. You don't get to negotiate your price at Walmart, but you do get to choose another place. And you might be able to buy exactly the same price or an exactly the same product for a lower price somewhere else, maybe. Walmart's pretty good at that. College is different. The higher paid professors, not always, but generally are better professors. So going to a higher institution is a higher cost, and we've got to get that figured out. Now, having said all of that, there's a lot of stuff. Technology coming out on new generation of electricity is going to completely change the way we consider electricity going forward. But there's a bureaucratic government control in the middle of it. Texas is the most deregulated, and it still has this major holdup in the council overriding the prices of electricity. Anytime you split up an industry but you maintain governmental control, you're going to have a weird Frankenstein of socialism and capitalism. Either one could work. They each have their own flaws. Some of the flaws are bigger on one side or the other. But when you combine the two, you kind of get the worst of both. You know, if we look at Denmark, it's a great capitalist economy with a socialist pay structure. It's a weird contraption in that we've got for-profit institutions that are doing very well and a socialist system, and it seems to be working well. Now, they have a very homogenous culture. It works well, and this kind of goes directly back to the banking issue. If your customer base is all one industry, it's easier to make decisions, but it comes with a greater risk when things go wrong. When we have our system is not designed. It's bureaucratically put together by not just by a committee, but by opposing committees, lots of them everywhere. We really need to put some perspective on that. And at this point, the beginning of that, it looks like something we don't know. How do you take this apart? How do you control how things are paid for? How do you bring back some of the control to the actual customer? We have to start throwing some spitwads. We have to figure out what sticks, because the system is getting worse. We've got better treatments and less access to those treatments. That's a problem, and we got to figure it out. We got to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side. If you would like to join the conversation, the email address in here is jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And I will be back on the other side of these very important announcements. And we are back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you would like to join the conversation, the email address in here is jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the Personal Wealth Coach. And Philip is saying, drink some water. Your voice is annoying me. I am sorry for annoying you all with my voice. I drank some water, but there is no guarantee that my voice will not annoy you. We are not making any warranty to that suggestion. Thank you very much. All right. I'm going to change the subject a little bit. We have people that ask us about our bumper music when we're first coming on, and then bagpipes and so on. And what's the reason for that? Number one, we like bagpipes. It kind of scares away the people that don't like capitalism as well. Capitalism as a concept, its father was a guy named Adam Smith, the good Scotsman, been to his gravesite, versus Karl Marx, who's a German, or was a German. So those two competing philosophies, which, by the way, Adam Smith didn't believe that he was competing with anyone with his capitalism. It was well in advance of Karl Marx. He just said that if you leave people alone to do what's in their own best interest, so long as it doesn't impede the interests of the people around them, then it raises the whole society, as if by an invisible hand. Now, a lot of people that are against the concept of capitalism skip the part about so long as it doesn't impede the interests of the people around them. A monopoly would impede the interests of other people. Hurting someone to make a profit is not okay. Getting a better deal than someone is. Well, Karl Marx also had this beautiful idea, from each according to merit to each according to need. And it's a beautiful concept, communism. Capitalism is a beautiful concept. Now I've just offended everybody. You've got equal opportunity offense here. All right, so I say communism is a beautiful thing. This is an area of study of mine because it's behavioral finance. It isn't economics in the traditional sense, even though it was written as economics in the traditional sense. What is a commune? At its most basic, it's a family. I have two children, one of whom is totally illiterate and unemployed. The other one is barely literate and totally unemployed. Totally drain on society. They are not doing anything. I mean, they're not even looking for jobs. The fact that they're 8 years old and 3 years old is a statement of, so what? This is a member of society. Shouldn't they be preparing the world for their presence and earning their keep? Well, no. And I'm okay with that. I'm going to pay for them. Now, I might argue with them about how many toys they're allowed to buy at each trip, but from a perspective of what type of economy is that, it is purely communism. There's no doubt about it. Communism is a commune. It is a group together, a community. And that's beautiful. It's the thing that most capitalism supporters want to protect, is a family unit. Capitalism is about a lot of communes working together to find the best price. It's a little weird, and I can say they're both beautiful things. They're not in opposition to each other. They become in opposition to each other when they're mandated. And one of the things about a commune is one of the most efficient methods of economy. The Shakers in the early 20th century kind of developed what we consider it furniture today. They built the American concept of what furniture is. They invented the circular saw, which is used everywhere. This is kind of a cool thing. It was a commune, and communes tend to fail on the third generation. Kind of weird. Same's true with a family who's done well in capitalism. The Rockefellers is a good idea, a good concept, but if you look at every major wealth gatherer, they tend to go bankrupt in the third generation because the third generation doesn't remember the work that went into acquiring the wealth on capitalism. And in the commune side, communes work really, really well as long as everybody's a volunteer. As soon as you're not a volunteer, as soon as you're mandated to work, it falls apart. So the second generation at the Shakers, they saw what their parents had done and the excitements that their parent has brought to the work that they were doing and to the beauty of living all together. But the third generation growing up kind of feels like, I don't have to work. I'm going to get paid anyway. In the Soviet Union, they had a saying at the fall of the Soviet Union in the decade leading up to it, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And that's a concept that's true in a non-voluntary commune. When you take socialism, which is a kind of a weird political hodgepodge of communism and capitalism, instead of based on community, it's based on society. So there's different implications there. You've got a socialist system overlaying it, and there's some degree of, hey, I earned this because I paid into it in socialism. And you say, all right, well, the United States is a capitalist country. It's not socialist. Social Security is socialism. It's even in the name. Medicare is socialism. Most capitalists in the United States will not refuse their Social Security payment when it's time to get it because you paid into the thing. You feel entitled to it. That's why it's called an entitlement, because you feel like you earned it. Is that a bad thing for a society? No, it's actually good for capitalism. It does slow down growth because less than 100% of your income is going toward your own living and your own reinvestment in whatever you're doing to earn more. Some of it is going to people that aren't earning things, that aren't building society better in the traditional capitalist system. But by giving that payment out every month, let me kind of give you a comparison. In the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, we didn't have a Great Depression. Why? I mean, the scenario could easily have led to it. And when you compare it to the actual Great Depression, a lot of the same characteristics were present with banking failures and runs on banks and stock market crashes. So one of the major components that were different, though, is that there was a continual paycheck going out to Social Security. So people kept buying stuff. There was a big component of that. A major percentage of the United States is getting Social Security. So when the economy suffers, that's still happening. That's still money flowing into it. So now we have a weird hodgepodge. The weird thing about this weird hodgepodge is it isn't weird at all. There is no such thing as a pure capitalism. There's no such thing as pure communism ever. And as a philosophy, it doesn't make sense anyway. I think Karl Marx had this. He was a critic of political economy. That was what he did. He was a critic of the political economy. And if you go back to the 1800s, the economy was really a politician-driven thing. The week before last, I talked about the Federal Reserve and how it used to be the place where people that didn't get reelected for Congress for whatever reason got appointed to the Federal Reserve Board. It didn't work as well when that was the way it was run. It really was a political economy. And come forward to Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker, and Ronald Reagan said to Volcker, hey, you're going to put us into a recession. And he said, yeah, sometimes that's my job. And I'm not going for political reasons to make it that we don't do this, because it's more important to preserve money than it is to get you reelected. The reason why George H.W. Bush didn't get elected was a combination of read my lips, no new taxes, and then new tax, and that we were in a recession during the election. Bill Clinton's motto was, it's the economy, stupid. Now, it wasn't George H.W. Bush that put us into that recession. It was Federal Reserve raising interest rates, and Greenspan was a part of that. Well, Greenspan's not going to change his actions because he's an academic. It's not a politician. It was better for the U.S. economy, but we got a different president out of it. So there's a lot of components that need to be looked at. Marxism, I don't think he would have liked the term Marxism. All right. Well, I'm out of time for this week. Hopefully I have changed your viewpoint, or at least added some fodder for your next conversation. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we do give individualized, customized investment advice and portfolio management to people of relatively high net worth. The local line is voicemail during the weekends, real life people during the week, 254-947-1111. You can reach it toll free at 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 1-800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, read the newsletter Going Back a Long Ways, listen to the radio program Going Back a Long Ways, and contact us through the contact form or email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.